Audio.
Thank you for calling the SALT Institute, located at 700 North Fairfax Street, Suite 600 in Alexandria, Virginia, 22314. Our office hours are Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. If you wish to leave a message, please press 114 and leave a message in that mailbox. Thank you and have a good day.
Hi, my name is Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek. It's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and the first episode was The Man Trap, which featured a creature that lived on salt. It's interesting that you wanted me to press 114, because they were on planet 113. But here's the gist of it, is I want to talk to someone about salt. I want to talk to them in depth about salt, and I thought you guys were it. If you can call me back, that would be great. I'll leave my number, and I hope we can figure this out, because why would a creature so crave salt be so intelligent to be able to change shape, but not be able to ask for what it wants? For salt. That's all it needs. It confuses me, and it makes me actually sad the more I think about this episode. So I'm hoping maybe you guys can illuminate me, and elucidate what's going on in this episode. It's episode one on Netflix, The Man Trap. And I'm hoping we can figure this out. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
They are insane!
In the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate.
But red frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
And it's real!
It's not a promise I'm getting.
That little, there'll be whales here.
I'm going to be honest with you. This has not been my best podcast starting out with. As you heard a second ago, my call to the SALT Institute went unanswered. Emails have been unreturned. It has not been an auspicious start for this podcast. I'm going to be doubly honest with you. This is the second time I'm recording this intro. The first time, I had the microphone turned in like a weird direction, and it sounds like I'm speaking from a tin can. A tin can! Like in the 1940s. Does anyone under the age of 35 understand that reference? Probably not. It doesn't matter. But it matters to me. This has not been a good start for this podcast. For Mike McCafferty, who just wants to talk about Star Trek, who just wants to talk about himself in the third person, and yet here we are, trying to cobble it together. Much like the way they cobble together, with an inauspicious start, the beginning of Star Trek, with The Man Trap. As earlier stated, I'm Mike McCafferty, and we are starting out this podcast by talking about the very first broadcast episode of Star Trek. September 8th, 1966, on NBC, is when science fiction truly began. That's a bold statement, Mike McCafferty, says Mike McCafferty. Yes, it is, but I believe it'd be true. And yet it started out not as good as it could have. Not as bold as it could have gone. The first episode was The Man Trap. Written by George Clay Johnson of Twilight Zone fame. A good pedigree for that. It is a good episode, but it's not great. If you like X-Files, you're going to like this. You're going to see the transition between Twilight Zone and X-Files. Because this is a monster of the week. No bones about it. Or are there bones, as in Leonard McCoy bones? I'm teasing ahead to what this episode's about. But in fact, that's what it was about. There's no one else here in this room right now. I'm recording this solo. I talk about these episodes sometimes. Sometimes I have my friends here with me. But the gist of it is that while I'm talking about these episodes, especially these early ones, I really got to get this stuff out. It's really important to me. I'm going through my Star Trek midlife crisis, trademarked, and to be able to talk about these, be able to relate these to me is really important. And if you don't care about that, then I don't think you care about anything. So you certainly don't care about Star Trek, and you probably don't care about me. But you need to, and I'll tell you why. Because things can start out poorly, and 50 years later, you can look back and realize it was the start of something amazing, that people were to pick themselves up and keep on going. The Man Trap, and it should be called The Person Trap or The Human Trap. A little sexist there. The episode's a little sexist. I grant you that. I grant you everything. We deny nothing. Star Trek IV. The Man Trap was the first episode to air. Not because it was the best episode. Not because it was the most spectacularly written or best acted. But because it was the one that was available to air. Science fiction was still very new to the television industry. How do you make a science fiction show? What does a planet look like? How does a ship move? How do we make this stuff work? This is pre-computers that they're working with. It's ships on sticks. It's strange lighted backfields. It's all sorts of stuff they've never figured out. And so the special effects were going slowly. And a lot of them weren't ready. The Corbinite maneuver was not ready. The Balance of Terror was not ready. But the Man Trap, with minimal amount of special effects, was ready. And so that's the one they went with. The Man Trap deals with loneliness. And I can certainly relate to that. You can certainly relate to that. You're listening to a podcast right now, probably by yourself. Maybe it's with a group of people, but most likely it's with yourself. Through earbuds, or in your car, or wherever you're listening to it. But it's about loneliness at its core. As I said before, it's not a perfect episode. There's a lot of issues with it. But there's something to it, which even then, even despite the bad reviews by The Hollywood Reporter and Variety, something that made people want to come back. As I said earlier, we start in Planet 113, or 113, M113, going, we first see the Enterprise approaching to give a checkup to Dr. Robert Crater and his wife, Nancy Crater, with whom Dr. Leonard Bones, quote-unquote McCoy, used to have a thing with when he was in his 20s. Now, this is the first problem about this episode, is that this episode is primarily about Bones. And that's because this was the fifth episode shot. So by that point in time, they really wanted to look at some of the other characters. We address Dr. McCoy. We have long segments there with Uhura. And we touch upon Sulu as the botanist slash scientist. He's slowly coming around to the helm. It's interesting to watch in this episode as he starts out doing botany. And then he eventually makes his way to the bridge. And he's eventually going from one station to finally to the helm. It's like they figured it out during the episode that he should be the helmsman. It's a very interesting progression with Sulu. But this one is primarily about Bones. Kirk is part of it for sure, but he's more along for the ride than anything else. And it's also primarily about the creature. The salt vampire. The salt vampire. Does that make any sense? I don't know. That's why I really wanted to talk to thesaltinstitute.org to help me figure out, can a creature survive on only salt? The episode starts out with them beaming down to the planet and finding Dr. Crater Nancy, whom Bones thinks she looks beautiful, like she's 25 years old. We've all seen our girlfriends and seen them in different light when they looked the same age they did a long time ago. But he really sees her as looking like he's 25. But Kirk sees her look like she's 45. And crewman Darnell thinks she looks like a girl he once knew from the Wrigley Pleasure Planet. Nancy is not Nancy. She's a creature. She's a salt vampire. A salt vampire. And when she leaves the ruins, and by the way, they have beamed down to this planet, 113, planet 113. Who calls planets 113? Won't you call it like 113? It's kind of odd. But they beam down to this planet, and they're amongst ruins of a great civilization that Dr. Crater is investigating with his wife, Nancy Crater. But Nancy slips out and kills crewman Darnell. She sucks the salt out of him. NaCl, salt. She takes it from him. But they don't know what's going on. She feigns that he swallowed a weird plant. Who would walk around and eat a plant on an alien planet? It doesn't make any sense. But you know what? Bones and Kirk, they buy it. She kills a couple more crew members. And then eventually she goes on the ship and she can change shape. This creature, this salt vampire, can change shape to whatever you're thinking about, whatever you desire. She becomes Crewman Green, this kind of creepy dude who walks around and kind of pursues Yeoman Rand. It is really like a creepy, has weird sexual overtones to it, as she's being accosted by guys on the ship. And again, like I said, there's a lot of weird sexism in this episode, so it's not a good episode to start out with. And certainly the over and undertones of sexuality are not super cool. But this guy's chasing around because she has a salt shaker. And we'll parse through the weirdness of this, that this creature, which can assume the shape of whatever you want to see, essentially, and communicate and make a complete chameleon-like change, can't just go and get salt someplace. He has to pursue, it has to pursue Yeoman Rand with a salt shaker. She goes into botanist Sulu's room with his crazy puppet hand plant, Beauregard. My God, that thing is horrible. If you haven't seen the episode, watch it just for that. It's a terrible hand puppet. It's a guy's hand to make it look like a plant. And he can't get the salt from her. He steals it from someone else. He tries to attack Uhura by turning into an African-American man who speaks Swahili. It's a great episode for Uhura. Really fleshes out her character very nicely. But he can't get the salt from her. He kills a few more people. And then they beam down the planet and they get to Dr. Crater. And Kirk and Spock figure out what's going on, that this creature can assume different forms. But here's where it gets a little weird and a little sad and a little strange. He relates this creature to a carrier pigeon or the buffalo. In that once there were millions of them roaming around. And then for some reason, they became decimated. Maybe they ran out of salt, which, again, I don't quite understand how that happens. I don't know how you lose salt, but somehow there was a lack of salt on this planet, and they're all gone, save this one, which killed his wife, Nancy Crater. But because this creature became Nancy Crater, he learned to love it and to take care of it. But now they're out of salt, and they needed more salt. This creature's now on the ship, threatening Captain Kirk's crew. And so he doesn't really care that much about the fact this is the last of its kind, which is really a not cool idea for Star Trek. And this is where I have some of the issues with it. Later on, the creature, disguised as McCoy, tells Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock during a briefing that this creature, it just needs salt to survive. That's all. And that this is one of its hunting mechanisms. This is exactly what it does. It's not malevolent. It just simply needs salt, and this is the way it has to go and get it. And what makes me sad is that this creature, as intelligent as it was, building a vast civilization, simply couldn't say, hey, I've been killing some of your crew member, but that's just who I am. Can I have some salt? The Dr. Crater wouldn't say, hey, this creature's been masquerading as my wife, but now it needs salt to live. It's the last of its kind. But Kirk doesn't care about that. Kirk just wants to get rid of it because it's killing his crew members. Now, this is important for the series because we need to see Captain Kirk be strong. We need to see his devotion to his ship and his crew. And yet, in the end, the way it turns out is rather sad. Eventually, it comes down to the creature turning back into Nancy Crater in Dr. McCoy's room, asking McCoy to save her from Kirk, who has salt tablets in his hand. And she's so hungry, she's got to get to them. She pushes McCoy out of the way. She hypnotizes Kirk. Spock breaks in. He punches fake Nancy Crater until she slaps him out of the way. Then she turns into a real form, this weird kind of creature with octopus-like hands that places its hands on Captain Kirk and starts to suck the salt out of him. It's a salt vampire. At that point in time, McCoy realizes that this isn't Nancy, and he shoots her. She turns back into Nancy and comes towards him. Leonard, please. He said, God forgive me. And he shoots her one more time and she dies. At the end of the episode, they're all on the bridge. And Captain Kirk ruminates, saying, I was just thinking about the buffalo. And the three of them ponder this as the ship flies away. That's the first episode of Star Trek. That's the first thing that greeted America and the world. It did good in the ratings, got 40% share. Won the night. It was a hit. But there's something that bothers me about this episode a little bit. The fact that they were so willing to dispatch this creature, the last of its kind, that they weren't able to do everything, they weren't trying to do everything they could to capture it, to hold it at bay, to somehow preserve it, this last of its species. Instead, they killed it. As I'm going through my midlife crisis trademark, my Star Trek midlife crisis trademark, it makes me think that as the salt vampire diminished and faded away, maybe those of us who loved the original series are slowly fading away. Maybe we're going away. Maybe we are going the way of the salt vampire. And soon there won't be very many of us left. And we'll have to change our shape and tell people we like TNG more than the old series. We'll be ashamed to say it. We'll say, oh, no, I actually like Enterprise more than anything else. Oh, gosh, yeah, Star Trek Into Darkness. That's a great movie. We'll change our shape to blend in with the rest of them. And then suck the salt out of them. I don't know how that analogy works, but it makes me a little maudlin. It makes me a little sad to think about it. I don't like that. Let's make a call.
Hello?
Tony?
Michael McCafferty.
Tony, you know what I want to do.
What do you want to do, Mike?
Tony Caselli, I just want to talk about Star Trek.
I want to talk about Star Trek.
Outstanding. Tony, I want to talk about the man trap, the salt vampire.
Oh, it's been a while. Oh.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to launch this on you, but I thought about talking. We were talking. Tony and I were texting back and forth about the Deep Space Nine episode Duet, and I want to get into that. But I want to move a little bit chronologically, Tony, and talk about the salt vampire a little bit. Can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. As a little bit of backstory, Tony is the artistic director of the Williamson Theater Company. Is that correct, Tony?
That is correct.
Yeah, he's been my friend for, 20, 30 years, something like that.
Jesus, oh, Pete. Well, not 30. How old are we?
I don't know.
20-something.
It's been a long time, but Tony, you haven't aged a bit. Like Nancy Crater, you haven't aged, Tony.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. So Tony...
You look great, Mike. I didn't want to embarrass you, but you look great.
No, it's good. I feel good. I feel as though my life is turning around. It's not the deadly years for me. It's not Shades of Grey. We're turning back the clock, Tony.
No, I think this podcast is what's doing it for you. That's just my 2 cents, but
no, I'll take it. I mean currency is useless in the 23rd century, Tony, but it's okay. I'll take it from a historical standpoint. So Tony, okay, so I just had a long sort of diatribe about the man trap. Tell me what you remember about it.
Wasn't this the first time that we saw? Because it was the first episode, you know, aired, but also in the series, wasn't this the beginning of like the expendable red shirts?
Yes, yes. This had a high incident of I think Ensign Darnell or Crewman Darnell was the first one to die. I think he's blue or yellow. I think he was blue to start out with. So.
I just remember that kid. I say kid because now we're old, Mike. I remember that kid being like lured away by someone from. Oh, it wasn't Risa. Risa came in the Next Generation. What was the other one that they used in TOS?
Yes, they called it Wrigley's Pleasure Planet, Tony.
That's what it was. That was before Risa. That was the original series version of Risa. Was that Wrigley's Pleasure Planet?
That's like
you can get all the gum you want.
Yeah, it was like the worst name, isn't it? It's you go to see a Cubs game and get free gum. That's what it was all about. It's.
That's great.
Oh, so one of the some of the themes I was talking about here was the fact that they end up killing this last of its kind creature, and that it's kind of a weird first episode because a lot of the tenets which later on continued in the series are sort of rejected in this because this is a creature. It's a smart creature. It's not a threat if it's fed, and yet they're forced to kill it.
Right.
So it feels like one of those episodes that it should have been buried kind of deep in the season, and yet that's the first thing the public saw.
Yeah, it is a little weird because, you know, especially having, because McCoy kills it, right? And it's the image of his old flame or whatever.
Yep, Absolutely. Yeah, that's the and so he has to kill it and then it just like dies on the floor and
you're right. Setting it up that way, it's weird because that's such sort of an anomaly based on the way that they did so many episodes of, you know, we can be better than that. We have to find another way and you know, all of those things. For the first one to be like, oh, here's this thing. Nah, there's no other solution. We're not going to try that hard. Let's just kill it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is weird.
Yeah, it's not a great reflective episode of the first. It's not a great first episode. It's more a McCoy episode. It's more of kind of like a contained show, but you know, you do what you can. So, And I was talking earlier.
Well, out of all the characters too, I mean, you know, Spock and Kirk are awesome, but McCoy was. I imagine watching this in order. It was interesting because over the course of the next, you know, three seasons, McCoy so much becomes the heart of the show.
Yeah.
Like the one who represents the humanity and do the right thing all the time, you know. He's so much that force. So, yeah, it really is interesting that they started that way. Wow, okay, cool.
Yeah, so... And then I was kind of I also kind of bridged out, and if people who are listening to this podcast are basically hearing the same podcast twice, but I want to talk to you about this, the idea that the original series is now fading from people's collective consciousness. Now it's the 50th anniversary, but in some ways, those of us who grew up on TOS and then later on TNG, but TOS especially, we're fading away. Almost like the salt vampires, you know, we're losing our relevancy. We're losing, you know, we're slowly, you know, dying off to you know, for lack of a better word.
Well, I think, and this is your Star Trek fan and your friend Tony saying, I think losing our relevancy is a little harsh way of saying that because you're in the middle of your Star Trek midlife crisis.
Yes, and that's trademark, Tony. Yeah, you're right, but. But Tony, don't you feel that sometimes? Like I talk to people about Star Trek and they have like blank expressions on their faces and they don't know about Captain Kirk and those people.
Right. No, I know. It really is. It's one of those things that they're these iconic things, and when you say it, people know what it is. But if you try and get in depth with it, they get lost.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
But you know, in some ways. I mean, that's everything. That's progression. That's life. You know, you're an actor. You're out in Hollywood. Well, if somebody brings up to you what I'm going to mention a name a Buster Keaton, you know, you can go, and forgive me if you're a Buster Keaton fan, anybody, but you can go, oh, God, yeah, Buster Keaton, sure. But then when people start getting into the details of it, you kind of go, I don't know. Yeah, I know he was big, and he led to this, and this movie. You know what I'm saying? I think it's okay. It's because when you look at where the rest of it has taken us, you know, we've still got Next Generation is currently still people know DS9, and then all the way through. Now there's a new series coming, and maybe, just maybe, it'll be good. You know, so we can look back and go, oh. You're the fathers
we
stand on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Too deep.
No, this show is all about going deep. This show is all about like not just like deflecting off the surface of the deflector shields of Star Trek lore. This is about us digging deep, Tony. All right. Well, Tony, thanks.
All right, Michael.
Thanks, buddy. You're a good friend, and I will I hope you get better, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, man. Be well. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Tony's probably right. My analogy about how I'm fading away like the buffalo, like the salt vampires, is probably not quite 100% on board. But like the man trap, it was good enough. They needed something to start out the show. It didn't matter what it was. They needed to put something out there boldly, and they did it. Just like I do this every single time. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to make mistakes. I'll edit this, but I'm not afraid to make some mistakes on this. And I'm going to boldly go forward on this, whether or not I have sodium in me or not. Because I'm Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Non-sequitur, your facts are uncoordinated.
When the train comes in, everybody runs.
Feral Audio.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you